Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Stephen Demours. Stephen is the author of America the Almighty, the Maverick Hyperpower, and is a former employee of the U.S. State Department and on the board of the Citizens for Global Solutions, which is the descendant of the World Federalist Association, an organization I've been a member of since the 1970s, and the UN United Nations Association. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you. It's good to be on your show.
Now, your book is very timely because we, as a country, have since 9/11 and since the presidency of George Bush, we have become increasingly reviled around the world for our rogue supernation status. And this, I think, goes back all the way to the emergence of the United States as a superpower with the outcome of World War II. Can you start us back there? What were the opportunities that the U.S. had with the its emergence as a world superpower in World War II and the creation of the United Nations? What do you think the trajectory could have been with the United Nations and the U.S., and where did we go wrong?
Well, certainly the United States, I think, did the right thing in the beginning when President Roosevelt and then President Truman basically worked with the leaders of the rest of the world to establish the United Nations, and we could have made the United Nations stronger and more democratic and more effective back then. But hindsight is 20/20. I think one of the biggest mistakes we made back then, from my point of view, is insisting on the veto power for the five permanent members of the Security Council, who were, of course, the winners of World War II. And that that veto is now the great sort of stuck place of international relations and international progress in the world. That basically prevents an awful lot of constructive action because one of the permanent five, any of the permanent five, France, Germany, Russia, United States, and China, can virtually stop significant action by the international community. So I think that was certainly not doing that would have been one of the best things we could have done at that time, and we slipped up in insisting on that. We handed the veto as a tool to the Russians, to the Soviets, and they used it liberally for all through the Cold War. Basically, the United Nations was partially, if not completely, paralyzed all through the Cold War, partly because of the veto. So I think, and of course, just generally the American-Soviet rivalry through that period paralyzed the UN. So really the first opportunity for the UN to be an effective organization in terms of bringing about peace and security in the world was after the end of the Cold War. And the high watermark for that was UN Security Council approval for the rollback of Saddam's aggression against Kuwait back in the Gulf War. And, we went to the UN for that. We got UN sanction for that. We did it under international law. We had a huge and genuine international coalition behind us in the Gulf War, and it did not bring about the kind of vilifying of the United States that the Iraq War under Bush Jr., has brought about, because, of course, the latter war was, first of all, unwarranted on the facts, and second of all, was not supported by international law.
That's interesting that you point out the lawful nature of Bush 1's war, because actually I opposed it at the time, but there were many progressives who were of two minds about that war, because it was one of the first post-Cold War engagements where U.S. power could legitimately be seen as enforcing world law. And that was something that we've been calling for and hoping for quite a long time. And George Bush Sr. said that this was the beginning of a new world order. And his son's new world order is entirely different from the one that his father seemed to have envisioned.
Right. In a way, it's almost the exact opposite. Bush Sr. envisioned a new world order in which the United States was a leader and a cooperative player in a basically a legal and institutional system that stabilized the world. Bush Jr. is basically running, you know, developing an American empire of coercion and brute force, sort of over the objections and fear and dislike of the rest of the world. And of course, that generates that not only alienates our allies and undermines the war on terrorism, but it also generates more terrorism. It motivates our enemies to attack us, and it weakens our alliances.
Now, some people who are skeptical of the prospect of global solutions, federalist solutions to world problems, think that the UN will never be able to be a strong institution because of the irreconcilable cultural differences between freedom and peace-loving peoples of the West and the cultures of the East and Islam that don't respect life the same way we do, or whatever kinds of rationales they use. Obviously, you're more optimistic about that, but it's hard to be optimistic in a context of a quarter of the world still living under communist rule, and another quarter of the world heavily influenced by authoritarian Islamic governments. Isn't that an irreconcilable problem?
I think it's a problem. I don't think it's irreconcilable in the long run. I do think it's irreconcilable in the short run, in the sense that there's a limit to how much we can strengthen and democratize the United Nations when it has members who are vicious dictators and when it has members that are basically communist. This isn't too paradoxical a term, a communist oligarchy like communist China, but what we see is democracy gradually gaining ground in country after country and replacing dictatorships and oligarchies. And also we see capitalism gaining ground in communist China. So I think when we project the longer term, we're going to see a diminishing of these the number and power. As a matter of fact, we've already seen a dramatic diminishing the number and power of dictatorships in communist countries, and replacement of those with democracies. The further we go in that direction, the easier it is to strengthen and democratize the United Nations. But I do recommend, in the final chapter of the book, when I'm talking about what are the solutions, a caucus of the democracies. And by the way, this is an idea that has been advocated by former Secretary of State, among other people, at the caucus of democracies, in which democracies sees, in effect, gang up on the rest of the world instead of the reverse, and begin to bring about reforms in the United Nations that are attractive to democracies. One obvious kind of simplistic example is the Human Rights Commission changing the rules so that only democracies that respect civil rights can be members of that. And right now it's controlled by dictatorships and human rights abusers, which is a wild absurdity. So for the short run, we need a caucus of the democracies having a much greater say in the United Nations, working together to limit the power of the dictatorships. In the long run, I think the dictatorships will disappear from the scene, and then we will have an opportunity for international law to become as effective as we might hope.
Well, I'm really glad to hear you say that, because I think one of the key questions is how we strengthen global institutions is how we strengthen their legitimacy, and they don't have very much legitimacy so long as there are all these dictatorships that many people would never want to live under, at least other people's dictatorships that they wouldn't want to live under, and so. Another part of it is that it's not directly elected, that it's so distantly removed from any kind of effectual control at the bottom. Do you support a reform to create at least one house of the UN to be directly elected?
Yeah, I think that probably is not possible when we have so many dictatorships and when we have a country like communist China. But the short answer is yes. I think in the long run, what we need is a body, maybe somewhat loosely analogous to the European Parliament, that is of representatives who are directly elected. And I would add, of course, that at least initially and in the short run, that body would be advisory. It would not have any real clout or coercive power. But a body like that would have much greater legitimacy in a lot of ways than either the Security Council or the General Assembly, and I think in the long run would accrue to itself more and more power by virtue of its legitimacy, and we would see a tremendous improvement in democracy at the global level if we did that.
There's a kind of ironic twist to the Bush's opposition to global solutions and his unilateralism, and that is that it has forced Europe to get its act together in some ways to have a more united voice, or at least to figure out how it's going to have a united voice. I mean, all the media attention goes to the fact that Eastern Europeans have different attitudes from the French and the French have different attitudes from the Britons. But there is this discussion among all our allies about how they're going to respond to the craziness of the Bush administration. And in that, they're joined in by the rest of the world who, for their own reasons, are opposed to it. So it seems like dialectically is what we used to say on the left, is dialectically the Bush administration may be strengthening the creation of global institutions.
Yeah, that is a great irony I've been watching with fascination. And even of all people, Tony Blair, at one of the meetings of the European efforts to establish a constitution, even Tony Blair admitted outright that part of the reason for doing this was as a counterbalance to American power. So while he's going along with Bush on the Iraq War, on the other hand, he's working with Europe in establishing a counterweight to the excessive power, at least from their perspective, the excessive power of the United States. So, it is moving. Bush is throwing his weight around, is, in fact, moving the world toward greater cohesion, at least our European allies, toward greater political cohesion, because they recognize they have to do that in self-defense.
I'm speaking with Stephen DeMores. He's the author of America, the Almighty, the Maverick Hyperpower. Stephen's longtime activist with various Federalist causes. And I'm Jay Hughes. This is Change Surfer Radio, a voice for the future global government to come, the voice of the 21st century. And one of the other things that I think comes to mind for me about this question is, what are the material forces that are pushing us towards the need for global solutions? Because you point to several places where there's a need for various kinds of global solutions, such as UN treaties and so forth. But we also have economic trends which require global governance of one sort or another, the forcing of capital to have us all go to the bottom of our to have the lowest wages, to have the fewest environmental regulations and so forth, the global arms conflicts that we have and the need for collective security. And so those are the two places it seems like, you know, if you're looking for forces of history that are forcing us to create global solutions, it would be the economic and the military.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think even more the economic rather than the military, because we have such a tightly integrated world economically now, global capitalism is such a powerful force. It's really kind of the dominant force in the world right now, and yet it's extremely unstable. I mean, it's extremely unconcerned about human well-being, concerned exclusively about profit. So what we have now at the global level is a parallel of a 19th century robber baron capitalism that we had in the United States. And in one sense, the history of the evolution of government in the United States, aside from the two world wars, which were major factors, a lot of the evolution of government had to do with controlling the excesses of capitalism, protecting labor, preventing wild oscillations of boom and depression, and more recently controlling the environmental destruction of large corporate enterprises. So, those things will all have to be done. They simply have to be done at the global level if the planet is to continue to be habitable. And as that happens, we will have to develop global institutions and democratic institutions to implement those changes. So I see. Yeah, I agree with you. I see economics as a major factor in driving a sort of progression of global governance that drives the kind of the world together into a more tightly integrated, politically integrated, and administratively integrated world. And certainly, arms control is another factor. Particularly, I think, preventing a proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and especially nuclear weapons, things like that are extremely dangerous. Just that requires close cooperation among other nations, and that kind of close cooperation really requires institutional mechanisms to carry it out.
In terms of actual creation of global institutions, one of the hugest dilemmas that we face is the inability or unwillingness of the UN to actually get nations to pay. The UN, the U.S. was withholding, $500 million for quite a number of years from the UN. And yet the UN has all of these peacekeeping missions and expensive operations all around the world. So what is the progress that we're making towards actual creation of a UN tax or some kind of secure funding mechanism for the United Nations?
Well, I don't think we're exactly making progress toward that, although I do think it would be as terrible a thing to the ears of conservatives as it may be, it would be a good idea to have certain kinds of UN taxes. So the United States, by the way, at one point owed $1.4 billion to the UN, which was really crippling it. We paid back some of our back dues when Bush realized that he was going to have to do that in order to get any kind of cooperation with other countries through the UN and the war on terrorism. So it was basically our dilemma, the war on terrorism, and our need for the cooperation of the rest of the world that drove us to pay back some of that $1.4 billion. We're still about $500 million, about $500 million in arrears on our UN dues. But there have been some polls that have showed that even the American public is amenable to the idea, for instance, of taxing certain things that are extremely deleterious, like serious pollution of the environment or taxing large arms shipments to other countries, and then using the funds generated by that to bring about a reversal of that process. In other words, using funds generated by taxing pollution to promote anti-pollution measures and that kind of thing. So where there's a specific problem that is specifically global, and the creation of the problem is taxable, even the American public seems to be willing to consider taxes that would have the reverse effect. Taxing the release of pollutants would slow down pollution and would also provide financial support for other international activities. It has to be approached with extreme caution, though, because of the neuralgic sensitivity to any taxes, even at the national level, let alone at the UN level, on the part of the conservatives in the United States. Taxes are as bad a word as Ebola or SARS, it seems, to the conservatives in this country. So we have a long ways to go to be able to move in that direction.
I'm speaking with Stephen DeMoris. He's the author of America, the Maverick Hyperpower, and I'm Jay Hughes. This is Change Surfer Radio. The creation of a standing UN army has been a long goal of the Federalist Movement, and yet it's one of the most paranoiac of the visions of the American religious right and the various nationalistic forces around the world, because it would actually create the context if there was some kind of conflict between, you know, hypothetically in 30 years between the United States doing something terribly contrary to world opinion and the UN, that the UN could actually then intervene in the U.S.
Right. I think the right-wing paranoia on that certainly is a huge factor in terms of preventing that kind of much more modest and quite legitimate action to create a UN peacekeeping force, the standing UN peacekeeping force. Such a force has been envisioned and, as a matter of fact, been under discussion for some time. We're talking about maybe 10, 20, 30,000 troops in contrast to the millions that the nation states have. We're talking about costs, $1, 2, 3 billion, whereas the United States federal defense budget is $400 billion. So we're talking about something that would be an infinitesimal fraction in size and power. Of the size and power of the United States government, and therefore, of course, would be no threat at all to this country or its sovereignty or its military clout. But people just absolutely go into paranoid conniptions at the thought of that. Conservatives in the United States, yeah, we have to cobble together forces from all over the place, and it takes months. It sometimes takes a year or two to do that, and by then, disastrous things have happened. And for instance, right now in Darfur and Congo and Sudan, basically what's needed is a force to stop the militias that are raping and killing people right and left in Darfur. We need an international force to do that because the governments of those countries are not willing to do it. But we don't have any such force, and it would take quite a while to put it together. So, yeah, there's a need for that kind of a force. It would be, as I say, a tiny fraction of the military clout of the United States. And also there's a need for a police force to sort of clean up after conflicts. It would have been very helpful if we'd had a viable police force to move in and prevent the looting in Iraq, for instance, after the Iraq War. But there is no UN police capacity to restore order in post-conflict situations. So there's a need for a standing capability like that as well. And again, that would be so tiny by comparison with American power. The idea of it being a threat to American national sovereignty is really pretty silly.
Stephen, one of the most egregious places for many American progressives and liberals where the Bush administration is ignoring the pressing needs of the world is global warming and its clear intention to never pay any attention to the Kyoto Protocols. And there is some scientific debate about their veracity, which I think we all have to acknowledge, but their utility. But this administration is just clearly not interested at all in the question and has done everything it can to spike the science behind it, you know, to pretend that the three dissenters out there are weighed against the 3,000 scientists who are consensus. So what path forward can there be for us if we don't get this administration out of power?
Well, I really don't know what path there can be without getting the administration out of power, because basically the administration is totally in the hip pockets of the oil companies. They are practically an extension of the oil industry. Almost every one of Bush's top people is an oil millionaire, and the oil industry has now definitively, I think, lost the argument that global warming is not happening. They're trying to claim that global warming is not happening. It's very clear that it is, with huge, huge areas in Antarctica the size of the state of Texas melting off, and the Larsen ice shelf in Antarctica is a 1,000 feet thick and the size of Rhode Island breaking off and falling into the ocean. So there's no question, and all over the world, and particularly the oceans, things are warming. So there's no question about that anymore. I think even the handful of scientists who claim that that's not true are giving up on that argument. But the next argument has been that it's not man-made, and therefore there's nothing we can do about it. But the ice cores in Antarctica indicate that, you know, that there are air bubbles in the ice going way, way down deep in Antarctica that have been ice layers that have been laid down thousands and even millions of years ago, and scientists are looking at those air bubbles and finding the composition of the Earth's atmosphere as the carbon dioxide is increased in the Earth's atmosphere 1,000 times faster. It is increasing 1,000 times faster now than it ever was before. That's a real shocker, and it's that increase started with the Industrial Revolution, but it's increasing now, and it corresponds to the amount of carbon dioxide we're throwing into the atmosphere from our factories and our auto exhaust. So we do know that it's happening and it's man-made, and we need to make decisive movements to slow it down. And that would be hybrid cars. That would be using solar power, using wind power, using more efficient buildings. We could meet the terms of the Kyoto Protocols without breaking a sweat if we chose to do so. But the Bush administration chooses to do nothing.
And a story that I think symbolizes some of our European allies' exasperation with the Bush administration is after the Bush administration abrogated the last-minute agreement of the Clinton administration to participate in the International Criminal Court. Apparently, when the International Criminal Court was created at the Hague or wherever the ceremony was, they put little sandbags around all of the flags of the world because someone in Congress had said that they were going to invade, that they might have to invade those countries if an American soldier was ever captured and held under the International Criminal Court. Can you tell us more about that story? That there was some movement in the U.S. Congress to actually say that we would go to war to protect U.S. soldiers.
Yes, well, actually there is an act that was passed in Congress that has been derisively referred to as the Hague Invasion Act. misnamed the American Service Members Protection Act, because it says that we can actually go to war to rescue one of our soldiers if one of our soldiers is ever hauled before that court. The ridiculousness of that is illustrated by the fact that the court is designed to have no jurisdiction in the case of soldiers or civilians, for that matter, of a country that has a viable judicial system, and nobody is going to argue that the United States does not have a viable judicial system. So if one of our soldiers or officers is accused before the court, all we have to do is notify the court that we will investigate the allegation, and immediately the court loses jurisdiction. And that's true whether we're members of the court or not. So it's all the idea of an American soldier before that court is a paranoid fantasy. It has nothing to do with the reality of the way the court is set up. And so it's the Hague Invasion Act is just a ridiculous gesture, but it's one that really indicated a hostile, bellicose attitude toward our European allies, and really did kind of frighten them.
Although, you know, the idea that U.S. soldiers could never appear before it, it may be suspicious in and of itself that we, you know, that we had to make that kind of a political compromise in the creation of that act. I mean, certainly other nations, other democratic nations would have insisted on that as well. But when we see what happened at Abu Ghraib and the inadequacy of the U.S. investigation, you know, just attempting to blame it on a couple soldiers here and there instead of indicting an entire pattern of tacit acknowledgement of the inevitable necessity of torture and coercive tactics in the investigations there, you know, it seems like we could have used an outside force to follow this where it needed to lead.
Yes, but actually, such an outside force does exist in the sense that it is at least possible in principle that other people besides those soldiers could be accused before the court, and even though, in other words, up the chain of command, people could be accused before that court. And if they were accused, the United States would have to agree to investigate the allegations, and in investigating them, might have to do something a little bit more extensive than what it has done. So the court does serve the beneficial as a beneficial effect of putting pressure on even democratic governments to get their act together to investigate their own atrocities, and in that way, I think it will put, over the long run, it will put some pressure on the United States to do more thorough and credible investigations of its own people when atrocities like that are committed. So it's a beneficial force in that way, even though it's safe to say that Americans won't ever actually be indicted before that court.
Well, I really appreciate your coming on today, Stephen. The book that we've been talking about is America, the Almighty, the Maverick Hyperpower, written by Stephen Damours, and that's Damours, and he has a nice website that you can find by Googling America, the Almighty. And also, I highly recommend that everyone look at the website for Citizens for Global Solutions. It's globalsolutions.org. And check out the campaigns for global federalist solutions, which Stephen is advocating in this book. So thanks for joining us today.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.